This is Jesus speaking in these verses. Matthew chapter 5, beginning in verse 17. I'm reading from the New International Version. Do not think that I've come to abolish the law or the prophets. I've not come to abolish them, but to fulfill them. For truly I tell you, until heaven and earth disappear, not the smallest letter, not the least stroke of a pen will by any means disappear from the law until everything is accomplished. Therefore, anyone who sets aside one of the least of these commands and teaches others accordingly will be called least in the kingdom of the heavens. But whoever practices and teaches these commands will be great, will be called great in the kingdom of the heavens. For I tell you that unless your righteousness surpasses that of the Pharisees and the teachers of the law, you will certainly not enter the kingdom of the heavens. You have heard that it was said to the people long ago, you shall not murder, and anyone who murders will be subject to judgment. But I tell you that anyone who is angry with a brother or sister will be subject to judgment. Again, anyone who says to a brother or sister, raka, which is a Hebrew curse word, is answerable to the court, Aramaic. And anyone who says, you fool, will be in danger of the fire of hell. Therefore, if you're offering your gift at the altar and there remember that your brother or sister has something against you, leave your gift there in front of the altar. First go and be reconciled to them. Then come and offer your gift. Settle matters quickly with your adversary who has taken you to court. Do it while you're still together on the way, or your adversary may hand you over to the judge, and the judge may hand you over to the officer, and you may be thrown into prison. Truly, I tell you, you will not get out until you have paid the last penny. So as we begin this morning, I want to begin in those early verses, in verses 17 to 20, to start to think about what Jesus is saying. Verse 17, do not think that I've come to abolish the law or the prophets. I've not come to abolish them, but to fulfill them. Jesus begins that way because what he's about to say may sound like he is setting aside the teachings that God gave to Israel. It might sound like he's setting aside the Old Testament. Jesus wants us to be very, very clear that whatever we're going to find in this Sermon on the Mount, it's not about abolishing what had come before. It's about fulfilling it, and we're going to have to think about what it means for the law to be fulfilled in Jesus. Another thing that we find here early on is, for truly I tell you, this is verse 18, until the heavens and the earth disappear, not the smallest letter, not the least stroke of a pen will by any means disappear from the law until everything is accomplished. Some of you remember the King James language there, not a jot or a tittle, right? Well, those are references to Hebrew, the Hebrew language. The jot is the smallest letter in the Hebrew alphabet. It's called a yod. It looks a little like an apostrophe. That's the jot. The tittle is a little flourish on the end of a letter in Hebrew that distinguishes one letter from another. Many Hebrew letters look exactly the same except for a little flourish, and that's called the tittle. So what Jesus is saying is not the tiniest letter in the Hebrew alphabet, not the tiniest mark that demarcates letters will disappear from the law until all has been accomplished. Until the heavens and the earth disappear. Not the smallest. Until the heavens and the earth. Are they still here? Oh, they're still here. So is it. All is not. Now, some was accomplished in Jesus, and we're going to talk about that today. Some of the law was completely fulfilled in him, but much of it has not yet been finished. Jesus wants us to be very, very clear that the law still has a place in the new covenant of Jesus. Now, we're not under the old covenant of Moses. We're not under that covenant. You and I were not at Mount Sinai when the Israelite people made that covenant with God. So the covenant of Sinai, and you can find this in the book of Exodus, beginning in chapter 20 and going all the way through Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy, that law was an agreement, a specific agreement that God made with the people of Israel about 1446 BC, if the biblical dates are to be believed. There are scholars today who say it was 1290. I go with the 1446. But in that day, God came before the people and he gave them an agreement. And he said, if you live in these ways, then I'll live in these compatible ways. You and I did not come to Jesus through that covenant, right? We came through the covenant of Jesus. But the teachings of that covenant remain. It's important that we start this way because it's how Jesus started the sermon. If you forget these first three verses and you just go on and read the rest, you can easily come to the conclusion that the law of Moses is now gone. But Jesus starts his sermon by saying, that is not what I'm doing. Dallas Willard, in his book, The Divine Conspiracy, which is one I recommend to people who really want to understand the Sermon on the Mount, it seems to me Dallas Willard had a real line of sight on it. The entire book is really about the Sermon on the Mount. He said this, "To be sure, law is not the source of rightness, but it is forever the course of rightness. To be sure, the law is not the source of rightness, but it is forever the course of rightness." Let me tell you the difference between a legalist and a Jesus follower. So a legalist obeys as a means of control. A legalist obeys in order to control God's response. A legalist has a list of things that they think God wants them to do, and they do it so that they can get things out of God, whether it's heaven or blessing or direction or discernment or healing or whatever it is they're looking for. So a legalist uses the law as a means to control God. And certainly the Pharisees in some ways were legalists, and Jesus was very critical of that. Jesus is not with the legalism thing. You and I can't control God. There's nothing we can do to make him do things. But a Jesus follower doesn't look that different oftentimes in their behavior from the legalist. But a Jesus follower obeys because they trust God. The faith comes first. A Jesus follower doesn't obey because they're hoping to control God. A Jesus follower doesn't obey out of some sort of exercise of personal strength and discipline and will. A Jesus follower obeys because we trust that God knows what's best for us, and because we believe he wouldn't ask us to do something that he wouldn't equip us to do. Because we believe in the kingdom that he's described, and we have the courage to put our values at risk by living into it. To be sure, law is not the source of rightness, but it is forever the course of rightness. First thing I have to say is what Jesus is doing, and you heard it. You have heard that it was said, "Do not murder." But I tell you, do not be angry with your brother or sister. What Jesus is doing is going to torment you if you think what he's doing is writing new laws for legalists. That's not what he's doing. Dallas Willard may help here too, and I'm sorry to quote him twice, but here it is. This is a quote from The Divine Conspiracy. "The most constant whim historically has been the disastrous idea just mentioned, that Jesus is here giving laws. For if that's all he's doing, they will certainly be laws that are impossible to keep. The keeping of law turns out to be an inherently self-refuting aim. Rather, the inner self must be changed. Trying merely to keep the law is not wholly unlike trying to make an apple tree bear peaches by tying peaches to its branches." Yes, impossible, one standard reaction now has it. That's what they are. "But therefore, all the more suited to thoroughly crush human hopes than were the laws of Moses, forcing us to turn to grace for forgiveness. Jesus is presented as more relentless and meaner than Moses, and we have all been subjected to so much well-intentioned meanness that we're prepared to believe it. The holier, the harder we think." We could hardly be more wrong. So far from being additional laws to crush us or show us we can't make it on our own, of course we can't. The separate parts are distinct perspectives on the sweet life of love and power, of truth and grace, that those who count on Jesus can even now lead in his kingdom. The law came by Moses, but grace and truth came through Jesus, the anointed. His teachings illustrate how those alive in the kingdom can live through the days and hours of their ordinary existence on their way to the full world of God. The Torah, the law of Moses, begins in Exodus chapter 20 when God gives the Ten Commandments to the people of Israel. Let's understand what they are. The Jewish people thought they were destinations, that if you could obey this law, you would have arrived at holiness. Jesus reveals that's not true. It never was true. The law could never make a person thoroughly holy. That's over and over again repeated in the Old Testament and in the New. The law is a starting point. So humanity has become, by the time of the Israelites, and only worse so now in many places and pockets, irredeemably self-centered. Well, God in the law of Moses What he's essentially doing is beginning to turn Israel towards godliness. So the law is a starting point. It's a beginning. It doesn't make the full turn. So if you think you can go to the law of Moses and find the fullness of what God wants of his people, you've misinterpreted what God was doing. What God was doing with the law of Moses is giving us a starting point. This is where the road to godliness begins. It begins with not worshiping other gods, not making graven images. It begins with honoring the Sabbath. It begins with honoring your parents. It begins with not stealing. It begins with not bearing false witness against your neighbor. It begins with not committing adultery. It begins with not coveting the things. This is where it starts. This is the beginning. So these are beginnings. They're beginnings, but they don't finish anything. There's a lot of things they're still doing there that you and I might say, well, I wouldn't do that, and you probably shouldn't do that because it was a beginning. What Jesus begins to do is to show you other plot points on the road to godliness. But if you don't know where it starts in the law, you don't know what he's doing. You cannot start with Jesus. Because if you start with Jesus, you have no idea the road that came before him. And without knowing the road that comes before him, you don't know your way out of sin into godliness, because the road out of sin began at Sinai. And that's what Paul does. When Paul is wrestling around with whether or not leaders in the church should be paid, do not muzzle the ox while it's treading out the grain. Well, that's in the law of Moses. But Paul says, hey, the law of Moses said when an animal is working, you let it eat. And so Paul says, stands to reason, because the law is the starting point, that in the church, if someone's working, they should be paid. Or at least fed. So for Paul, the law of Moses is a starting point, but Jesus tells us where those things were aiming. And this is what I want to get to. You and I might not have believed that the commandment not to murder, many of us thought that was the whole deal. If I want to be holy, what's required of me is that I give you permission to live. And then I'm holy, right? No, that's just the starting point. That's a good start. Giving other people permission to live is a good start. You have to start there. But Jesus is telling you, okay, now let me tell you where that road is headed. The kingdom trajectory, where you're headed with don't murder, is don't hate. Verse 21, you've heard that it was said to people long ago, you shall not murder, and anyone who murders will be subject to judgment. But I tell you, so Jesus is saying, let me give you another plot point on that road. You have to begin with not murdering, but Jesus then says that that road, another plot point on that road, is not hating. Anyone who's angry with a brother or sister will be subject to judgment. Again, anyone who says to a brother or sister, racha, is answerable to the court. And anyone who says, you fool, will be in danger of the fire of hell. Jesus is sort of telling us something that I think is so very important. If you want to get to the kingdom, you don't need your rage. That's not a law. It's a gift. Many of us think that we need our rage to serve God well. When somebody says something that I don't agree with or offends me or blasphemes my God, I need a little bit of rage to push back on them. But what Jesus is telling us is that the road that leads to the kingdom of the heavens, rage doesn't fall on that road. You don't need it. You don't need it. There's only so much you can carry on this road to godliness, and you need to be very careful about what you're taking with you. And Jesus is trying to tell us what we need and what we don't. And what he's essentially saying is you don't need your hate and you don't need your rage. And the thing that makes that hard for us is not that it's impossible, it's that we don't agree with him. I think my rage is a useful little tool to have. I may need it in this world. Don't let me leave it behind. That is an essential piece of navigating my way in this world, because people are going to do things to me, Jesus, and I'm going to have to get mad about it. And people are going to hurt me, and I'm going to have to hate them. This is the way the world works, Jesus, and I'm going to take it with me. But essentially what Jesus is saying is that the kingdom of heaven is a world in which rage will not have a positive benefit. Now, if you think about it for a while, that is the best news you and I ever heard. Rage is an exhausting emotion. Have you carried it? It works on you psychologically. It's a heavy load to bear. Matter of fact, when you take rage with you, there's not a lot of room for anything else to come. Jesus is telling you, you don't need it to follow me. Now, it's not because it's fine what other people do. God is the just judge of all the earth. Vengeance belongs to him. Justice will be done. What Jesus doesn't say, justice doesn't have to be done. What he says is you don't have to carry your rage with injustice anymore. That's good news, church. There's life beyond rage. The world operates differently. The world in which you and I live, if you don't fight for yourself, you get steamed over. If you don't stand up for yourself, you become a victim and a statistic. So rage and pushback and fighting is necessary in this world to make our way in it, but a kingdom is coming where those skills will not be necessary for justice to come. So Jesus says to his people, I started you by not murdering, because a culture that can begin with the idea that we should not murder will begin to walk towards a place in which there will be no hate. Jesus is more or less saying to those who are listening to the Sermon on the Mount, these ethics won't work here. If you're looking for ethics that will work in this world and make your life easier in it, you've come to the wrong teacher. Jesus is not trying to help you navigate this world. This world is broken. It's destined for fire. What he's trying to do is to help you to recognize what it will look like to navigate the kingdom of the heavens so that you can begin to live now in the freedom that will one day be yours there. And so Jesus isn't saying, hey, if you stop raging, the whole world will become a better place. He's not saying that. The world will be as bad as you remember it, believe me. But if you don't rage, then you follow Jesus into a kingdom that is coming. And Jesus says, I know that's not the world you live in, but come with me and we'll find the kingdom you've been looking for. It's a kingdom not of this world, but it is a kingdom that is coming to this world. There's more we don't need on this journey from murder. These are still on the same continuum from murder, that will help us better understand where Jesus is headed. And that's this next section. Repent, for there is life beyond you, beyond me, beyond the eye. Look at verse 23. Therefore, if you're offering your gift at the altar, and there remember that your brother or sister has something against you, leave your gift there in front of the altar. First go and be reconciled to them, then come and offer your gift. Settle matters quickly with your adversary who's taking you to court. Do it while you're still together on the way, or your adversary may hand you over to the judge, and the judge may hand you over to the officer, and you may be thrown into prison. Truly, I tell you, you'll not get out until you have paid the last penny. Life in the kingdom of God, the road from do not murder, ends in the road of in the place of do not hate. But there are stops along the way to test whether you're on the road. The first is, what do you do when you know you have an adversary? What do you do when you know someone has something against you? Remember, the road is, we start with don't murder. The final end result is don't hate. What are some stops along the way? And Jesus says, well, let's do a little quiz. Let's do a little test, see how you're doing, whether you're on the road. So tell me, when you know you have an adversary, when you know someone has something against you, what do you do? And of course, the Israelite answer would have been, I make my sacrifices to God and ask for forgiveness. And Jesus says, okay, yeah, you never took the road. Sorry, that's a different conversation. You're not on the road. I was trying to hope that you were going to. This is what you do. If you bring your sacrifice to the altar and you realize, this person has something against me, you go and make peace. Oh. So if I want to get from don't murder to don't hate, I'm going to have to be a person that puts peace before sacrifice. Reconciliation before worship. What happens if somebody's suing you? How do you respond? It's another point on the road to not hating. Do you take it to court and take them for everything they got? Make sure that justice is done? Pay whoever you have to, bribe whoever you have to, make any argument, make sure? Or do you try and make reconciliation before it has to go before the government? Do you try and make peace on the way there? So if we want to go from hate, from not murdering to not hating, then the way we can evaluate ourselves is how we are navigating the stuff on the road that leads both to murder and to hate. How do you resolve conflict in your marriage? How do you resolve conflict in the church? How do you resolve conflict on the road? How do you resolve this is the place to do the work. And the question is what I'm doing in this moment leading me to a place where hate will be exempted? Or is it leading me on a road that will actually lead to increasing hate? And you can tell whether you're on the road. Do you see what Jesus is trying to help us with? He's not asking you to be perfect, but he's asking you to be on the road that leads where he's pointed. This is what it means to follow Jesus. It culminates in Jesus when he's being crucified. And he says, Father, forgive them, for they don't know what they're doing. Jesus couldn't muster hate for the people driving nails into his hands. Now, that's quite an arrival. So for you and I, how do we apply this? Well, there's going to be a lot more in this sermon to try and help us with. But you and I have to ask ourselves, are we on the road to holiness? To becoming fully human beings? Or are we not? You were not made to hate. That is not who you are. And that's why you can't handle it. It's why it emotionally breaks us down. It's why it causes physiological symptoms of hypertension and heart disease and strokes. There's a reason your body falls apart when you carry it for too long, because you were not made for it. Jesus is trying to tell you something very, very helpful. He's trying to help you and I to understand what we were made for and what we weren't, what we can handle carrying and what we cannot. And you and I cannot handle carrying hate and adversarial relationships that are not reconciled and being sued constantly. We can't handle it. And Jesus is telling you, you don't need it. You don't need it. You don't need that rage. You can put it down. Jesus is not telling you what you have to do. He's telling you what you can do, because there's a kingdom that's coming that doesn't need that stuff. When you get to the gates, you'll have to lay it down anyway. So why carry it all the way up to the door? Jesus is telling you, you don't need that baggage. You don't need it. You might think it's doing something in the world. You might think it's bringing justice into the world. You might think it's making someone pay for something. You might think that there's some sort of a good reason to carry the hate with you. But Jesus is telling, there's no good reason. First, I will make sure justice is done for you. Secondly, I can heal anything anyone can do to you. So you will not be carrying those scars forever. In the new heavens and the new earth, you will be absolutely free of them. And third, you've got to trust me that I can handle the rage and you can't. God has wrath. People don't need it. That doesn't mean we don't need justice. That's a different conversation. We're talking about the heart attitude of hate and rage. Where are you on the road? See, the Jesus' gospel is good news. You can be free. You don't have to live this way. You can live this way because Jesus is coming. And a kingdom is coming where you won't need what you need in this world. And I know you need your hate and rage in this world. I know you do. But if we really trust Jesus about the kingdom that's coming, we'll let it go anyway and trust God with the consequences of our obedience.